Well, thank you. It's really a great honor to be here. I'm sure it's going to be a lot of fun. Please stop me, ask questions. I hope you have a great program here. I hope you have a great time at PI. And I just want to give you a little taste of the big question we're asking and the biggest things we see and the biggest bang that we do. And so this is my, so I work in different areas, but today I will mostly talk about cosmology. And so cosmology is the history of the early universe. And we're trying to figure out, you know, how did the universe unfold? What was the initial conditions, or if there was any initial conditions, and how did it go, and what is it made of? And but I don't want to tell you the story, you know, as a history from, you know, like evolution A and then B and then C. Instead, I will work backward. So that's why my title is backward. I will look at a specific type of objects, and in, for this talk, I chose a particular object. I chose the biggest one. So the biggest thing that we have in our universe. This is the one I will be looking at. I'll tell you what it is. And then we'll try to figure out from these things we see, how can we figure out what the history of the universe is? And also, how can we figure out what the laws of physics? Their goal is not just to test, you know, to figure out the history of the universe, but it's also to test the fundamentals of physics. All right, so let me start it. First, cosmology is a special in science in that we don't do experiments. Science is experimental, right? Physics is mostly experimental. In cosmology, we cannot do experiments because the universe happened only once. It just there. We cannot like redo it and change a little bit, turn the knobs and try something else. Okay, it's just the universe happened one time. You get to see it once, and you have to figure it out. You know, what the laws of physics are and what the universe is. But fortunately for us, the universe is really big. Therefore, there's a lot of things that are reproduced many, many times. So we get to see them like, so we don't get to redo the experiment many times, but we see many, many galaxies of all different shapes and different stars of all different, you know, particularities. So in some sense, when we observe many things, we just have a lot of statistics, and so we can still do science. That's why it works, even though we are not technically doing experiments like they do in condensed matter. So yeah, so what we do, so we're not experimentalists. What we are is, well, at PI we're mostly theorists, so we're actually doing mostly theory. But fundamentally, where most of the things I'm going to show you today comes from data, and what people are is they're observers. So they're looking at the sky. And so, and I want to look at one object because like, you could do a whole, you know. Could do cosmology is a big field, could do all sorts of things, but I'll look at just one type of objects, and we're gonna look at it with three different lights, so three different observations. Okay? So the first thing is gonna be visible light. This is the Hubble telescope. Do I have a pointer or just my hand? That's fine. So yeah, so I have this is the Hubble telescope. It's one of our nicest telescopes you probably have heard. It's in the sky right now. There's potentially a lot of telescopes like this in the sky. But most of them are secrets, and they're looking downwards at us. This one is looking in the right direction. It's looking upward, and it's looking for the sky. So this is a very powerful telescope. And so this is what we see with our naked eye when you look at the sky. It's a bunch of stars. And now this is what we see with Hubble. And I hope you can see this. So this is Abel 370, or sorry, 390. This is one of the biggest objects in the world. There's a lot of things here. So the object is not just the center. It's the whole thing. This is the object, the biggest thing in the world, as I will describe it. I describe it as an object because that's something that if you were strong enough, you could hold it in your hand and you could throw it. Okay? It means it's hanging together enough that I can call it an object. There are some things in the world that, of course, are bigger, but they're not really, you know, they're not holding together. This one is holding together as one distinct object. And each point here is a galaxy. There's no stars in this picture. It's just galaxies. And galaxies, each of them contains many billions of stars. Some of them are really weird, like this one has a big tail. This is not some lensing effect. This is the actual tail of the galaxy. Okay? So the galaxy had some collision, and now it's like kind of stretched out. Yeah, so this is Abel 390. We'll talk about this one quite a bit. So okay, so that's the first thing we see is visible light. And so what is this thing? Or, sorry, let me show you another one first. The name is a little bit whatever, XMMU, you know, number. I'm going to call it the X cluster. Okay, I'm going to explain what I mean by cluster. So this is another one. It's not extraordinary, you know, it's not as beautiful. It's right here, roughly. That's the object. The distances are here. This is I'm going to use parsec. This is a unit we use in astrophysics. So anybody know a bit what a parsec is? Yeah, a couple. Maybe I remind you. So parsec is when the Earth goes around the sun. So when we go from fall to spring, the stars that are close enough to us looks like they're moving a little bit. That's because when you look here, then it, you know you. The star looks this way, and then when you're on the other side of the sun, then the star looks like it's moved a little bit. So when a star moves by one arc second in the sky, the distance to us is one parsec. And so that's one parsec is a rough distance for stars. And so this object is about 5 megaparsec, so 10 to the 6 parsec, which if you convert in kilometer, it's about 10 to the 20, so 10 with 20 zeros. So these are very big objects. And this is what you see, this X cluster invisible. Right, so what are these things that are called galaxy clusters? The question? Oh, yeah. So they have about 10 to 1,000 galaxies. They appear to be held together by some kind of gravitational attraction. I don't know, I should have changed that. I mean, by gravity. Not some kind. So they're held together by gravity, which we're pretty sure is gravity. Then there is, and each of them, yeah, 10 to 1,000 galaxies. You see different galaxies here. So I'm not going to talk about galaxies or stars so much. What I want to talk about is the cluster. And some galaxies are very small. This is a dwarf galaxy. And some galaxies are like more like the Milky Way, like our own galaxies, like spiral galaxies and so forth. Each galaxy normally has a typical mass of, again, billions and billions of solar mass. So it's about billions and billions of suns. Okay. All right. So what do we do? So first we look at visible. So the first thing we can tell from the visible image is what we call the redshift. And so the redshift is the idea. So we see the light coming, and sometimes we see spectral lines that are coming because, say, a hydrogen atom absorbs a specific light rays with a specific wavelength. So then you see some absorption line, so you see some black in the spectrum. And so when we look at these galaxies, we see all these black lines coming from, we always know where these black lines are. They're coming from hydrogen or helium or other things. And the thing that we see clearly from any of these clusters is that all of these lines are shifted to the red. Okay. Nothing is shifted to the blue. Everything in the universe is shifted to the red. And that's why we call it redshift. It's literally a very simple formula. It's the wavelength that we observe compared to the wavelength that it was emitted, divided by the wavelength it was emitted. Okay, so that's what we call redshift. It's a measure of distance, because as you may have probably heard, the simplest interpretation for this redshift is that the universe is expanding. And so, the universe is expanding, so what happens is everything is going away from each other, and so this redshift is coming from Doppler effect, from the fact that as things move, oh, that's going to be nice. Beats the hockey stick. Cool, thank you. Great. All right. Doppler effect, right? So when you're moving, like when an ambulance is moving, right, the sound changes as it passes you. So when you move, the wavelength of something that's emitting some sound or light, the wavelength change. And so what's happening is all these galaxies are moving away from us. And so that's why it's looking like there's a redshift. Okay? The light is just everything is shifted to the red, so the wavelengths are getting larger. Okay. Everything is moving away from us. And this is due to, so this is telling us that the simplest explanation is the universe is expanding. Yes, question?
So, like, if the galaxy we were pointing around, like Hubble 2, was not moving in respect of the Earth, we would see that redshift?
Right, well, no, that's the thing. So. There are two. This is important. I was going to this. So there's a peculiar velocity. So there's the actual velocity of the galaxy. So if a galaxy is moving towards us, it could be a blue shift. If it's moving away from us, getting a redshift. And then there is, in addition to that normal velocity that everybody has, there is the expansion of the universe, which makes everything look like it's going away from us. So that's why so that's why I'm saying here, there's both a redshift due to the expansion of the universe. The universe is expanding, so everything's going away from us. And also there's a peculiar motion. So peculiar motion, we mean the actual motion of the object. And so some objects are expanding away from us because the universe is expanding, but they're also moving towards us. And so both of them contribute to the redshift. Other two questions? Yes? No, so both of them would be moving. So if a hydrogen atom, so this is a hydrogen atom by itself, let's say when it's making a transition between different levels, it will emit light, which would then move. If the hydrogen atom is moving towards us, this line would go this way. If it's moving away, it will go that way. The absorption line is the same. It's the reverse process. It's the fact that when light goes through, say, some cloud of hydrogen, the hydrogen is going to absorb the line. Absorb the light at that guy here. We actually mostly, well, it depends what you're looking for. So for example, if a galaxy is emitting light, but you see the galaxy is sitting behind a cloud, then we're going to see that the light of the galaxy has been absorbed. If on the other hand, you're looking directly at the hydrogen, then you may see some emission line. Okay. But really what we see is this with both emission and absorption on top. So we see everything together. And then we have to entangle the whole mess. So, yes?
As you said, like, the redshift is a mixture of the expansion and the negative motion.
That's right.
So how do you know, like, how do you make sure the what is really caused by the expansion?
Yeah.
The single part of the expansion.
Turns out that for most objects that are far enough away, the expansion completely dominates. The peculiar motion is a very small effect. That's why also we always see a redshift. Technically, we could see blue shift, but to see a blue shift, it turns out that the object has to be really fast or be really close by. Well, yeah, it has to be both, probably. It has to be close by and really fast. But indeed, we're going to get to this. We have to disentangle. And the idea is you look at many objects that are roughly the same distance, and then you can see that this one, slightly different redshift than the other, and then you can tell that this is coming from the peculiar motion. From the motion of the galaxy itself, so it's a little bit of work, but you can it says because the peculiar motion the velocity of the galaxy is a small effect usually compared to the expansion. Yes. Yeah, gravitational redshift would be another effect. This is when you have general relativity and the gravitational pull of an object like the Earth or a galaxy, you get redshifted also as you try to escape. It's not a big effect in any of these objects. It turns out that, in fact, for most of this talk, and you'll be very surprised, most of this talk, Newton's gravity works very well. You would need more like these the gravitational redshift, like where you're close to black holes or something. But when you see a galaxy, it's a very small effect. Great questions. OK, so the first thing we tell is the redshift. And so let's look at, for example, at this object. X, blah, 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 blah. So just the X cluster, it has a redshift of 1.4. Again, this is a somewhat easy measurement. And it's a measure of distance. It tells you it is at a redshift of 1.4. It also means, as you know, that if you look at objects that are further away in the universe, it took time for the light to travel. So it means it's also in the past. We see it as it used to be back then. So interestingly, this is what I was saying before. When the redshift is greater than 0.1, the expansion dominates over any motion. There's no objects in the universe that has that travels so quickly that it beats the expansion when you're a distance like this. As soon as you get far away enough, the expansion dominates, and everything we see is a redshift. We never see blue shifts. Now, one of the things that's interesting is this is actually close by. Okay, these galaxy clusters, and this is going to be important for later, these galaxy clusters, the biggest things in the world are actually recent. Okay? The universe started small and started building up. Okay? It didn't start big and then fragmented. Or it didn't start with a big object and then created galaxies. Galaxies came first. We have seen galaxies like quasar or gamma ray burst emission, which is our small galaxies. They've been observed all the way to a redshift of 7. So to put some, let me shift from redshift to time. Okay? So to go from redshift to time, I have to start assuming a theory. Okay? And so I'm going to have a stamp. This is the theory I'm going to assume. When you see this lambda CDM, I'm going to also explain what this theory is. when I put this stem, that means what I'm saying is only true in that theory. Okay? Redshift is something you can measure, but when I convert redshift to an actual time with seconds, I need to actually assume what the history of the universe is, so I need a theory to do that. And so I'm going to assume this model, lambda CDM. And so when I convert, for example, a redshift of 7, in this theory, it turns out that it's 12.9 billion years old. So these galaxies are really old. They were created 770 million years after the Big Bang. So they're very recent. They're very old object. And compared to our X cluster, which is much more a recent object. Okay? Just as a fun fact, redshift, because it's the expansion of the universe, it's not an actual velocity. The galaxies are not really moving. They're moving, they have their own velocity, but the redshift we see is mostly from the expansion. If you go at a redshift greater than 1.407, it turns out that the velocity that's due to the expansion is actually greater than the speed of light. So most of the stuff out there is because of the expansion of the universe, not because they're really moving that fast. Nobody's moving faster than the speed of light. But just because of the expansion of the universe, most of the universe is actually invisible to us. We're never going to, unless we can somehow figure out how to travel faster than the speed of light, but we're never going to catch up with these objects. They're really moving away from us very, very fast. So that's just a fun little thing passing. So this is supposed to be a gamma ray burst, which is just a galaxy that's very violent. Yes?
You said that the first cosmos were like a redshift 7 were older and the big object were
right.
This means that if like the redshift is bigger, there are going to be older objects always, or like?
That's right. So when you see something that's a bigger redshift, it's farther away. And the farther away we look means farther in the past. And so that means older. Okay, so indeed, we've been talking about this. I had already a lot of questions. We can do a first simple calculation. There's something weird about these objects. Let's calculate the peculiar velocities. The calculation will assume this. Okay, so as I said, by measuring the relative redshift between these, so a galaxy cluster is as many galaxies in the cluster. So you look at the different galaxies, you measure the relative redshift, then you can get the peculiar velocities. And so what we measure from observations is that the velocity roughly moves at about 800 to 1,000 kilometers per second. That's their average velocity. So now let's try to figure out whether this is a good velocity for them. And in fact, as I'm already telling you, it's too fast. And there's a simple calculation we can do. We know the escape velocity, right? The escape velocity is when the kinetic energy is equal to the gravitational energy. So the escape velocity, to escape the Earth, you need 11 kilometers per second, roughly. That's the escape velocity. So this is the escape velocity formula if you use just Newton's theory, right? So 1/2 mv squared is gmm over r squared. You may have seen this formula before, so this is just the escape velocity. This is if you assume Newton's gravity. All right, so we have, I told you, and let's do some calculation here. Let's assume there's about 1,000 galaxies, which is the maximum, each of which has about this mass. If I convert this in kilogram, this is about the result, 10 to the 45 kilogram. It's a pretty big number. The radius I already told you, it's about 5 megaparsec, or 10 to the 20 kilometer. And g here is Newton's constant, which you may have seen already. It's some number, 10 to the minus 20 kilometer. If you plug all of these numbers in here, so this times this gives you 10 to the 25, divided by 10 to the 20 gives you 10 to the 5. Take a square root, you get about 300. So simple calculation, just plug the number here. And so you see that for this galaxy cluster, the escape velocity is about 300 kilometers per second. But the velocity we detect is this one. And so if our observations are right, these galaxies should not be bound. They should be escaping. They're moving too fast. They should be freely streaming. So what's wrong? So this is our first puzzle of the day. the galaxies should not be bound, they move too fast, and there's only a few possibilities. Either we're missing mass, or our formula is wrong. I will take the radius to be kind of, because that's really easy to measure what the size of the object is on the sky. You just look at it and you know where it is, so you know the size. So it could be that, yeah, so there's only so few things that can be wrong here. R I'm going to take to be, it's pretty sure, so M could be wrong. G could be wrong. Maybe, you know, why would G be the same? We measure gravity on the Earth. When we measure gravity, we measure Newton's constant, G. Why would Newton's constant be the same here as it is over there? I mean, this is really far. We've never been there. We've never been there to measure G, so we don't know. Maybe they have a different G over there. And that kind of, maybe they have a different Newton's constant. Or maybe it's the 2 that's wrong. And this is meaning the formula could be wrong. Maybe it's supposed to be 2.5. You know. Or maybe it's not the square root. Square root is probably needed for the unit to work out. But so maybe the formula is wrong. And so that's the first puzzle. And so before we try to solve this puzzle, we'll first look with our different observation. So now let's look with, now we've been looking with visible light. Now let's look with X-rays. So there's two satellites here, again in the sky. This is XMM Newton. This is a European satellite, a European telescope, really. And then this is NASA. This is a Chandra telescope. Okay. And these guys look at X-rays. All right. And so this is our X cluster. It's kind of hard to see here. So this is our X cluster as before. So let me just. Here's what it looks in the X-rays. So clearly now, you can see that there's an object. Before, it was kind of just whatever. But now, there's clearly an object. And this is stuff that you couldn't see in visible light. And what it looks like is, this looks like you have some kind of big gas or something that's emitting X-rays. And indeed, in fact, this object was first discovered as an extended X-ray source in XMM Newton in the archive. So they were not even looking for this object. They just kind of saw it randomly. And indeed, so these X-rays is coming from intergalactic gas. So there is gas in between the galaxies. It's also called sometimes the intercluster gas, because we have a cluster. And the gas is very, very hot. This is a Kelvin, which is the same as Celsius, essentially, for this kind of temperature. It's really, really hot. This is more, you know, 100. What is it? Almost 1 billion, a little bit. 1/10 of a billion of Kelvin. It's really hot. And so that's why we're seeing X-rays. Okay? And then we can measure the mass of this gas, because we know how much X-rays is coming. And it turns out that, so indeed, we were missing mass. Because in my calculation before, I only included the galaxies. And so we weren't missing mass. We were missing about twice the mass. But a factor of 2 doesn't really help, right? Because if I go back to my formula, there's a square root here. So if I take a factor of 2 here, a square root of 2 is like nothing. So actually, I still have a problem. So that's not enough. And so here we get to our first, and you already probably heard this. That's where we need to invoke something else. There's two things. Again, the formula could be wrong. It could be that gravity that's not correct. And there's definitely a lot of scientists here at PI who are promoting these ideas of modified gravity, to modify gravity on the scale such that you can explain the discrepancy here. But one of the simplest explanations is just to say that there's something that we haven't seen yet. That's called dark matter. In fact, we can calculate from the gas, we can calculate the total mass. Essentially, that's because, let's say I look at the sun, and I tell you the sun is a big gas, again, it's plasma. If I look at the temperature as it varies, as a function of radius, I can figure out what the total mass is. Okay. And so if you do this calculation, you find that the total mass of the cluster has to be 6 times the mass of the gas plus the galaxy. So that means that this cluster that I've shown you at the beginning is only made of 5% of galaxies, 10% of gas, and most of it must be something else, which we call dark matter. So in fact, these galaxy clusters are really badly named. They're not galaxy clusters, really. They're dark matter clusters. They're really mostly made of dark matter. There's almost no galaxies in them. That's the first thing we saw, is the galaxies. And then the second thing we saw is the X-rays. And then, of course, we haven't seen dark matter. Now, dark matter, there's a lot of evidence for dark matter. But you should not believe dark matter until there's some other experiment out there that verifies it. The only evidence we have for dark matter is this kind of evidence I've shown you here. It's gravitational. We see that dark matter gravitate. We see there is a missing gravitational component. But we have not yet detected directly dark matter. There's a lot of experiments which are trying to do that. And you should not believe that dark matter exists until we detect it in some other ways than just gravity. Right, so, and in fact, dark matter, it's also not only needed for galaxy clusters, it's also needed for galaxies. This is actually how it was really discovered. Galaxies, it's the same logic. The stars and the galaxies, the stars on the outer edges, they move too fast. They should not be bound to the galaxy. In order for them to be bound, we need to add mass. The same logic, and this is how originally dark matter was proposed. But it's even more obvious in these objects, because in galaxy clusters, the dark matter is like the dominant component, not just a small part. So yeah, so it's pretty cool. This is what dark matter looks like, artistic rendition. I like it. Yeah, it's great. Again, there's what is it? We don't know. You guys are going to go see SNOWLAB. I'm so jealous. I've actually never been there. I really wish I would. I don't know if this is what it looks like. I just took a picture. I want to go. It's a great chance. It's a great lab. This is one of the many experiments which is actually trying to detect dark matter today. There's many, many others. In my opinion, they're trying to test one hypothesis. So what is dark matter? We don't know. Okay, it gravitates. That's pretty much the only thing we know. It's dark. That means we don't see it. So it doesn't couple to light. Or if it does, it's very weakly coupled to light. So the only thing it does, really, we know for sure, if it's to explain the data, it gravitates. It has a gravitational attraction. So we don't know what it is. The most a serious contender, one of the very serious theory out there, is so-called the weakly interacting massive particle, or WIMP. And so this is the idea. It's a small particle which has very high mass. And it's just out there. It doesn't interact with anything else. So that's the main hypothesis, and the SNOWLAB is looking for these guys, the WIMPs. A lot of other experiments are looking, and in my opinion, in 10 to 15 years, you'll either see the Globe and Mail, the New York Times say, we have discovered dark matter, bang, voila, it's resolved. Or it will be, 10 to 15 years will be like, dark matter is really not understood. Because if it's a WIMP, it should be discovered soon. So this is something that to watch out in the next 10, 15, maybe 20 years, or even maybe sooner. Okay, but so let's look, how can we detect dark matter? Well, let's observe with our third way to observe these objects. It's going to be gravitational lensing. So now, for the first time, we need a GR. I cannot just use Newton's theory of gravity. So I need general relativity. And in general relativity, the idea is that, unlike Newton's gravity, when I have a mass, it curves space-time. And so what looks like you're just going around because there's some attraction, actually you're just moving on your straight line, but what you call straight is actually curved. So it looks like you're going around an object, but you're actually moving on what you would call your straight line, okay? And yeah, so and the idea is this works for everything, not just mass stuff, but light. So even if you have just a light ray coming from behind an object, it will be bent because of the space-time is bent. And so this is how we can, and we know exactly how a mass bends the space-time. If you believe Einstein's theory, given Einstein's theory, we know exactly the relation between how much mass you have and how much bending of the light you should have. So if we can see an object behind some other one, and we can see the lensing, then we can figure out what the mass is. Okay, that's the basic idea. Now, it turns out the universe is really empty. Okay. It's very rare there's anything behind anything else. I mean, when you look at an object in the universe, usually there's nothing behind it, because it's just a very large, empty universe. Most of the universe is actually empty, really. There's nothing in it. But this guy is famous. It was the first well-studied example of strong gravitational lensing, the one I've been talking about. This is Abel 390. There's many. This is a big, big object that's close by. So as it happens, there's a lot of things just behind this object. And all the things that are behind are being lensed. And I'm not good enough to tell you which ones are being lensed. So I had to like take the observer's point of view, but you just look, there's tons of different objects. Like, this is a paper I took from the web, and they, like, C1, C2, and C4, these are three little dots. Well, they turn out to be all the same object, just seen different lens, okay? And so there's many different lensing events here, and then when you do all this, you can figure out the total mass of the cluster. Okay? Question on this? Yes. So the velocities, so this is galaxies in the cluster? Yeah, so it's relative to the cluster, not to us. So the idea is that this is one, like for example, for this object to be stuck to the Earth, it needs to be moving less than 11 kilometers per second with respect to the Earth.
Okay. Can you just pick the arbitrary point in the cluster and say that?
Right, so you go to the rest frame, as you're going to see. Yeah, so it's, yeah, you go to the, in the frame where the cluster is at rest. So in the frame where, in the you choose your coordinate system so that the cluster is not moving, and then you measure the velocities with that. Yeah. Yeah, well, the cluster, yeah, so you have to figure out, yeah, this is a good, the clusters themselves, so there's the expansion of the universe, then the cluster itself is moving as an object on its own, and then each of the galaxies themselves are moving inside the clusters. And so, yeah, you have to make many measurements of redshifts and try to figure out to, these are hard measurements. You're trying to subtract everything so that you say, okay, now I really just have the, and there's a lot of uncertainty, but it's easy. At this level, we're just trying to get the order of magnitude of the velocities. So if you're not trying to do something very precise, it is hard to make very precise these velocities, the value of the velocities. Good. Okay, but we can do better than strong gravitational lensing. We can do weak gravitational lensing, which is better than strong, even though it doesn't sound better. So weak gravitational lensing is you take a field like this. So imagine that each of these is a galaxy. It actually has a size. Now, if you put this into a lens, imagine putting it in a type of glass, but the glass is bumpy. Okay, it's very deformed. It's not like my glasses here. It's a very deformed lens. Then what you'll get is maybe something like this. This is like this many galaxies see through a very deformed lens. And the idea is if you use strong enough computers, which we have here even as a cluster, a supercomputer at Toronto, which actually had to close, I was told yesterday, because it was too hot to do any computation. But anyway, so if you have a supercomputer and you can run it, then you can actually figure out not only what the total mass is, but exactly where it is. You can map it. This is like the forefront of cosmology nowadays, is just actually map exactly where all the dark matter is. And so, for example, if you look at Hubble, you look through the ages, if you're good enough, you could actually really map all where all the dark matter is. And you can just map, if you're good enough, if you had enough time, supercomputers, you could try to map the whole universe. It would be really nice. Right now, we're just doing some very, very small parts. Because it's very computing, it's a very hard problem. But in principle, it can be done. You can literally map exactly what the lens has to be, and so you can tell where all the matter is. And so this is, for example, they actually just map, just a contour map of where the dark matter has to be. Let me show you one which is a little cooler. So this is Abel 1670, another cluster. And the white is dark matter. So we can't see dark matter. But they just looked at this guy for so long, and they figured out, oh, like, look, this galaxy is distorted this way. But this other galaxy is moved, or these three galaxies are all moved this way. And then they were able to figure out to map exactly where the dark matter is. Yes? Sorry? Weak.
With gravitational lensing, how do you tell that the galaxy is moved because of that, not because
mm-hmm.
it's shape?
That's true. That's very good. Indeed, the galaxies themselves already have an intrinsic shape to start with. So the question was, why? How do we know that the shape that we see is not just the galaxy, which has already had that shape to start with? And indeed, they do. They have different shapes. And in fact, we can tell sometime, oh, this is an elliptical galaxy, and so it should be shaped this way. And so this is included. So that's why, again, it's a very hard problem. Because indeed, you're not, this is a simplistic view. You start with point dot. But really, this is true. The galaxies have shapes themselves. We can tell some of them are spherical galaxies, some of them are ellipsoidal galaxies, some of them are Milky Ways. So we identify which type they are, what's the shape they should have, and what's the shape they now have. And then we go back.
And what about irregular
galaxies? Yeah. Just don't look at those. Yes. Okay, so let me show you one of the most famous clusters. The bullet cluster, this is what it looks like in the visible. Very nice cluster, beautiful, looks nice. It's actually two clusters. Here's what it looks like in the X-rays. So you have a big X on top of the optical. So you have a big X-ray gas, and you have like looks like shock wave. So this is actually two clusters that had a collision recently. Well, you know, cosmologically recently. and then this is what you get from the weak gravitational lensing. So this is where the dark matter is. So you can tell it's really two different clusters. And if you put together everything, this is a famous image because it's one of the very rare cluster images where we see that the gas and the dark matter are separated. So what happened is you had a collision, and the dark matter did not collide, apparently. They just went through each other. The gas collided. The galaxies didn't see each other. Like, there's only a few galaxies out there, so they missed each other. The gas, of course, is everywhere, so the gas really did interact strongly with each other. And so they have shock waves and all sort of stuff. But the dark matter just went through. Nothing happened. This is very well explained if you believe in the WIMP. So it's a weakly interacting massive particle. But again, this is most of the evidence we have of dark matter. It's from gravity. OK, so what's the big picture here? Let's do some cosmology. Let's try to explain where these guys come from. And we're going to do cosmology neglecting us. That means we're going to neglect all of the universe that's us. So all the protons and neutrons. So our universe is going to be very simple. Our universe is going to only have dark matter, which is a good approximation because, as I have shown you, 85% of the cluster is made of dark matter. So we're going to be right to a 15% accuracy, okay? And we're going to take dark matter to be a particle with no interaction with a mass. And then the goal is to set up a simple model and get those clusters as a result, so to explain where they can come from. So here's the model. It cannot be simpler than this. I don't think so. You're going to start with a universe which is expanding, and the only thing that in our universe is dark matter with some mass, which is going to be actually irrelevant. Then we're going to assume gravity, and I'm not even going to take GR. I'm going to take Newton's. Newton's theory, because general relativity can be hard sometimes. And then I'm going to need a spectrum of perturbation. So what is that? So if I have a completely smooth universe and it's expanding, nothing is ever going to happen, right? If it's very, very smooth, it's just going to stay smooth. The idea is you have to have some small perturbations. And then then because of gravity, these perturbations are going to grow, and then they're going to give us the structure we see. So we have to start with some small perturbation. So I'm going to assume that I have those small perturbations. And I have a whole spectrum of those perturbations. I have a perturbation on different wavelengths. And then I put a lot of these particles. I'm going to take n of them. And I do a so-called n-body simulation. This is really a trivial computation. It's just that because you have so many particles, it will be impossible to do it by hand. Okay, but a computer, even the most stupid computers, can do this. And so here's this, what it looks like. So we start with a box. This is our universe. It's expanding. You're not going to see the box growing, but it's really expanding. Space-time is expanding. Then you just put a bunch of particles, a lot of them, in the box. And then you put some small perturbations, which you can't see, but they are there. And then you just let it run, okay, on your computer. And this is what happened. As the redshift goes down. And so what you see here is that naturally, without us doing anything, you see filaments all over the place. And when two filaments intersect, this is actually where our galaxy clusters are going to be, roughly. They're at the intersection of these filaments. And then there's no galaxies here, because galaxies are made of stars, which are made of protons and neutrons and electrons, and I have not included those guys. So this is all dark matter. So there's no galaxies, there's no X-ray gas. Okay. So this is, again, the picture. See different step. You just get these filaments forming. Now let me show you a somewhat better simulation. This was a simple one. All right, so we're going to start at a redshift of 40. We're looking at a very small size. Can you see well with the light? Yes? That's super? Maybe just for this one, you can turn off the light. Can I? Or?
This one stays on.
This one stays on? Okay, well, there we go. So this is the simulation. So this is 500 kiloparsecs. So this is the size of a galaxy, actually. So it's not a galaxy cluster. And as the redshift goes down, you see the year going. The redshift goes way faster than the years. This is not a one-to-one relationship. Every point here is a particle of dark matter. Okay, there's nothing but dark matter. The color are all artificials. The point is that when you get something that's more yellow, it's getting more dense. Okay? So as time is evolving, we're getting more structure. So this is, you see these filament structure. Each of the stuff is coming in now. Oh, at a redshift of 7, we're starting to have an object here. So again, redshift of 7, that's when a galaxy forms. And so there it is. This is a galaxy. So it's not a galaxy cluster. Then just stuff just keeps coming in. They get distorted. The only interaction here is gravity. So when they get distorted at all, it's just tidal effect, like the tides, the moon. They just get the particles themselves, they don't touch each other ever. It's just gravity and Newton's gravity. Not even just simple Newton's gravity. Everything just naturally falls into each other and just keep things falling and keeps growing. So now here, you're starting to really to have an actual galaxy here. So if you had protons and neutrons, the galaxy would probably be like just at the center. Because what you see is the dark matter surrounding the galaxy. Okay. This simulation is called Aquarius. You can find this on the web. There's also another simulation by the same group. It's called Millennium, the Millennium Project. It's very, very large dark matter simulations. And they made some nice movies. There's some music, which I did not put in. But if you want to listen to it, it is, in fact, different music, depending on what your style is. So this is the universe forming as we see. Small, just going on. See how the redshift is going very slowly now. And the year just keeps on going. The year, again, assumes lambda CDM type of thing. You have bigger halos coming in. So sometimes there are dwarf galaxies surrounding other galaxies. Just keeps on going. And there's a lot of stuff out there. This is all dark matter. Any questions? Yes. How long did it took? So this was done by, this guy was a headmaster. This is done at the Max Planck Institute. How long the simulation? This is a good question. So they had the multiple, I don't know actually. I don't know exactly how long it
took.
That might not be too far, but I think it's more like months maybe. But I'm not sure. Indeed. So the universe is expanding. So for some reason, the universe started expanding. If the universe is only made of matter that attracts itself, then at the end, everything should attract. So the universe should just crunch back. So that's if the universe is only made of matter, at some point, we're going to stop expanding. In fact, for a long time, the universe decelerates. So that is, it's expanding, but it's expanding slower and slower. And at some point, it's going to stop expanding. And it's going to start contracting. So it's like an explosion. You just go in, And then because of the gravity, it's going to come back and crunch again. That would be a big crunch, yes. But it turns out that we have evidence now that this does not seem like it's what is going on. And partly, as you may have heard, it's because of this other thing. It's called dark energy. But all right, this is the data, which looks a lot like the simulation, which tells us that we're on the right track. What is this data of? So you look at the sky in some direction. Each dot is a galaxy. So we cannot see the dark matter. So we're using galaxies, and we're hoping that the galaxies are at the same place the dark matter is. But the thing you see still, just by looking at galaxies, you can't see these filaments. This is called the Great Wall in the sky, because it's a huge wall. But then you will have clusters at different places here. So this was taken by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So it's not a very fancy experiment. It's just a telescope, which is digital. So it just looks at the sky. It sees the galaxies. It measures the redshifts. So we know where it is, the distance. And it measures where it is in the sky, and then it puts a dot. Very simple experiment. Very powerful. Okay, so what we're going to do, the most interesting thing here is the perturbations. So we started with the universe with some small perturbations. Yes, question.
For that last picture, was the reason why there was no data in the black parts?
Yeah, because we haven't had time yet to look there.
Oh, okay.
Partly, and also where the telescope is. So the telescope and how much it can move. Any given telescope can only see a certain portion of the sky. If you want to see the whole sky, you have to put different telescope at different places. So this experiment is made, with a telescope which sees some portions of the sky, not all. Yeah. Okay. So now the thing that's interesting in this model is, let's say you could use this to test gravity, to test Newton's theory, but we already know Newton's theory is not really exactly right. But also, you could just ask where these perturbations came from. This was the most ad hoc thing I put in. I put some perturbations. Where did they come from? So perturbations, we can decompose into harmonics, sine and cosine. So for example, this is if I have a clarinet and I play it. Can you hear my clarinet? All right, so you get some harmonics. Okay. And so this was a particular note, and then you just get the harmonics, and supposedly it's not well played. Somebody played clarinet was telling me. But anyway, that's what a clarinet sounds like. This is what the universe sounds like. Okay, so this is what the spectrum, I'm going to explain what it is, and this is what the universe sounds like. Okay, so it's not as beautiful as the clarinet. So it's a lot more white noise, and actually it's very, from the theory point of view, it turns out that white noise is very beautiful, turns out. So it's not just some peaks, some simple harmonics. It's very broad. So it's like the perturbation, instead of being like just one note, like we just put one perturbation, like A, you know, we just put an A in the universe, and then the universe evolved. That's not what we did. The perturbations I was putting is something that's very broad, like we have everything. It's just like a noise, very complete noise. And that's what it sounds like. It sounds like noise. And so what happened is it's one of the simplest perturbations we could have put in. We call it scale invariant. So what the idea is, like what we started with, and it turns out that this is what fit the data nicely, is to, so here I'm plotting the power, so that just means the amount of energy, per a wave number, which is the inverse of a wavelength. So really this is just the wavelength of the sound. And I'm plotting it, so this is 1/wavelength, so just 1/length, it's called a wave number. This is the power, and this is the power spectrum. It's scale invariant. That is, it has the same power. So what we did is when we started our simulation, we put perturbations. We put perturbation of every wavelength with essentially the same power, the same amount of energy in each wavelength. So we start with, we put some small wavelength, we put perturbation. And these perturbations, really, you can think of them as perturbation of space-time, if you want. Or it's density. You know, we put a little bit more dark matter here, a little bit more dark matter there. Okay. And so what happens is if you start with some perturbations, dark matter will naturally fall towards where there's more of them because of gravity. And so that's why these perturbations just naturally grow. Okay, so if you start with some perturbation, they grow. But what's interesting is that the universe expanded. So here's the twist. You put all these perturbations, But at the beginning, and now I'm just showing one dimension, at the beginning, the universe is very small. So at the beginning, like this perturbation doesn't look like a perturbation. It's very, essentially, it's nothing. But as the universe expands, like, so from going from here to here, so I'm here, and then there's just, like, everybody feels like going to the left. So everybody in the universe wants to go to the left of the universe. Okay, this is a perturbation in the universe. And as you grow, suddenly it becomes clear that you all want to go down here. Okay. And then this one grows, then suddenly, and then this one, there's many perturbations. There's already many places you could go. And as the universe expands further, suddenly you see, oh, look, now I can go here, I can go here. So the idea is that the small wavelength, they come in first in the universe, and as the universe expands, you see bigger and bigger wavelength. Is that clear? This is maybe one of the most tricky part. It's the idea is that the perturbations are like all been placed somehow by somebody magically. This is really weird, okay? This is the most strange part of this model. It's like the universe, there's all these small perturbations, they've all been laid down. They're all existing. And as our universe expands, we just see them. So as the universe expands, suddenly we realize, hey, look, I really want to go on this side here because for some reason, there is a perturbation on this side. And the perturbation, you can think of like a small ripple on the space-time. And so what happened is the small scale, so the short wavelength, which means the large inverse of wavelength, so the large case, because they entered first, they've been growing for longer, okay, because they grow. And so what happens, the power, which starts flat, moves up like this. So the small scale have more power in them, so there's more, because the perturbation, you start it like this, but then as the dark matter falls in, it grows. And the small one, they've been growing for longer. So this is why this is what the power spectrum looks like. You can forget about the red curve. And then, indeed, that's almost what the data looks like. So the data indeed looks like this. And it actually comes back down. So this is what we detect. It comes back down, and the reason is because before the matter era, there was a radiation. There was a time where the universe was dominated by photon. And that actually decreased the power. But this is, you know, less important a bit. The point is it grows, and it decreases back a little bit. But that's the power spectrum. This is the thing that sounds like white noise, and this is the thing we detect. So we detect, so we see what the initial perturbation had to be. And they had to be like this. They had to have this weird power spectrum. Okay? There's one more step because again we don't see the dark matter. What we see is the objects. And so the last step we have to do is like you look at all these wiggles. So this is the dark matter, but only the very few objects are going to form. Because you only get an object when the dark matter reaches a certain threshold. So when you have enough of it, suddenly you get objects. For example, you get our Abel 390. So we only see these kind of things because we don't see the dark matter itself. So there's a bit of work going from the objects that we see to the actual curve. But the curve is predicted by the theory. And the theory is just a flat spectrum, a flat scale invariant spectrum, and then just gravity. And then you explain nicely this curve here. Yes, questions?
So in this model, is there an explanation for the perturbations occurring in the first place?
Or? Nope. They're initial conditions. Yeah, not nice, huh? They're just initial condition given by some powerful being. They're just all there. It's very, very unsatisfactory. And so we'll get to that. Yes? This is a good question. In fact, there's some proposals out there that they could be dark stars, which would be stars which mainly power by dark matter. But there's no evidence for that. I think it's a little. So actually, the sun has a little bit of dark matter inside, presumably, but not very much. There's dark matter all around us. right now. This is why Snow Lab is trying to detect the dark matter, which is living in this room. Yes?
Is there any possibility that there are some black holes made of dark matter?
Yeah. I mean, the black hole presumably would be made of almost could be everything. But yeah, it could be dark matter inside of black holes, definitely. Yeah. The questions? Yes? Yes. Yes, indeed. So the question is, so there's a cosmic microwave background, which the CMB, which I have not talked about, but it's something else that we can see. It's the afterglow from the Big Bang. And indeed, you can also look at the perturbation in the temperature of the CMB. And then you can see the same perturbations. This is another, so we're detecting the same perturbations. The physics of the CMB is a little bit more complicated, it turns out, because you cannot neglect baryons, you cannot neglect protons and neutrons, you cannot neglect photons. And so what happens in the CMB is you get acoustic peaks. There's a lot of physics. Versus here, it's a little simpler. You just have one peak. But it's the same physics. So the perturbations in the CMB are the same perturbations that we see here. OK? Good, good, good. And so like I was saying, collapse objects are rare. In statistics, what we mean is that they're just coming from the tail of the probability distribution function. And we can ask, for example, in this model, what is the most probable objects? And just to tell you a little bit, so this is, for example, some recent work, whatever. But the point is that it tells you like the mass of the objects and the function of redshift. This is our X clusters. And it turns out our X cluster can be explained by this data, but not very. It's hard, you know. So it's an object that's a bit rare. Okay. So let me, yeah. So what do we have? So there's a lot of things here. So what do we have? We can explain the large-scale structure of the universe using a gas of cold dark matter. That's the only thing I've been using up to now. You also need radiation early on a little bit to explain why the power went back down. But really, if I just have a gas of cold dark matter, it works. And the cold just means it's moving slowly. It's non-relativistic. But that's OK. And then we need to put some initial perturbations. These initial perturbations are scale invariant. You put them in their scale invariant. They're Gaussian, small details here. And they're frozen. By frozen, I mean they're all been created somehow, and they're all like just waiting for us to discover them. They're all out there outside of our universe. And as we grow, we'll see that there's a perturbation somehow waiting for us. It's kind of weird, but it's there. The model actually fails on very small scale, but that's normal because we did not include baryons. We did not include protons and neutrons. So this is work in progress. Yeah, don't worry about that. Okay, scientists are working on this. There's a problem in small scale. But that's where the galaxy is supposed to be. You know, when you zoom in on very small, we're supposed to be there. So it's normal that the data and the theory doesn't match because we did not include ourselves. But it's impressive that it works up to this level. The model also failed recently. And the reason for that is because we need to include something else. And you have heard about this. This is the lambda and the lambda CDM. So CDM is cold dark matter. Lambda is dark energy. And this is a weird thing. So what happened is recently, and this would be a talk on its own, and I cannot. OK, so in 10 to 15 years, I promise you that at least the WIMP, I should not promise anything, but the WIMP hypothesis, the weakly interacting massive particle, should be either right or wrong. And we should know 10 to 15 years. And then we can try other things. Dark energy, we have no clue right now. And I don't think we're going to know in 10 to 15 years. OK, it's really, we don't know what it is. And it's very hard to test it. But what it is that recently the universe started accelerating its expansion. So I was already mentioned, if it was only made of matter, it should just decelerate, it should stop, and then it should crunch. Surprisingly, and everybody was surprised, in 1998, astronomers looking at supernovae found that the universe was actually accelerating. It was going faster and faster. And the only way to explain this is there must be something out there that's beating gravity. There's something out there that push things apart instead of pushing them together. And this is what dark energy is supposed to be. For us right now, what dark energy does is that because it pushes things apart, it stops structures. So in fact, it's what's hard to tell in the movie, in the movies. But at a redshift of 0.5, actually structures stop growing, it turns out. These clusters, they keep forming, but at a redshift of 0.5, they stop. And that's because of dark energy. Because dark energy just beats gravity, and then it stops growing. Yes?
So are you assuming that dark energy kept getting stronger, and that's why, like, in 1998, they found that everything was starting to accelerate? Or is it just
right. Well, yeah, partly. So what happened is the dark energy presumably was there all the time. But as the universe expands, everything gets diluted. So the density of matter and the density of photons just gets diluted and diluted. And at some point, the dark energy, which probably was there all along, we don't know, but potentially could have been there all along, suddenly became the dominant source of energy in the universe. So before that, the dominant source was the dark matter. And so that's why we didn't see the dark energy until a redshift of 0.5. Yes? No, that's the thing. Dark energy does not get diluted at all. So that's why if it continues this way, the future of the universe looks really bleak. Because the universe is just going to keep expanding ever, ever faster. Everything is going to be, you know, separated away. We'll be sitting in our planet Earth, and everything will go away from us really fast. And the only thing there will be is dark energy. And so that's if dark energy stays like this, and it keeps on going like it's going right now, that's what we're going towards. It's a little bit depressing sometimes, but yes. All right. Yeah, question? Yes, it is. Well, it could be. Vacuum energy is like one theory for what dark energy could be. And it's a theory that gets the answer wrong. But that can be by many order of magnitudes. But it can be arranged maybe to work. That's a simplest explanation. It's also you may have heard of it as the cosmological constant, which is just a term that Einstein could add to its theory. It's just a pure constant. But the vacuum energy is the energies, quantum energy of everything has some, it behaves like a dark energy. And so it could be that that's what dark energy is. Yes? Yes. Well, that's a big question. Why was there a Big Bang? Yeah. This is a very good question. We don't know, I guess. We have a theory. We have some theories that, you know, but at some point you just have to set some initial condition and let it go. And the Big Bang is just set it up. You set a bath of photons and radiation, just let it go, it will naturally expand until it stops and comes down. So the thing with the theory of Einstein is that it's just not, there's no way, no easy way to make a static universe. If you're trying to make it, you just put some stuff in a box, it either crunch or it expand and then crunch, or so you could do that multiple times, or you can just expand forever. It doesn't stay there. And so it's not really unnatural to say, I have a bunch of photons. They're either going to do one or two things. They're either going to crunch or expand. So let's look at the expansion. And that's our universe. And then in some cases, it stopped expanding. And then it comes back and crunch again. In some other cases, it just expands forever. The hard thing, actually, turns out, is to actually make it that it doesn't move and doesn't do anything. That used to be the most popular theory. It's called the steady state universe. But it turns out that this now was replaced by the Big Bang theory, which is where it expands. So I don't have a better answer than this. I mean, it's one of the solutions that we can have, and it just naturally explains the data. So, okay.
Sorry, this is kind of irrelevant, but it was referring to what you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of what the perturbations are. So the idea is the universe actually turns out, I didn't say, but it turns out the universe is very flat. Yeah. It didn't have to be, but it turns out to be. And the perturbations are little bumps in space-time. You can think of them as little bumps in space-time. But they're not, I mean, you need a theory to explain where they come from. I mean, they are just bumps in space-time of different, you know, different height and different bumps of different values. But I mean, so yeah, this is where I'm getting to, is why, where do they come from? So because why, yeah, why? Why is this theory is weird. And the thing that's weird about it is why these initial conditions. Why are they Gaussian? By Gaussian, I mean they're really, the statistics are Gaussian. Why are they scale invariant? Why is there the same energy in every scale? Why are they frozen on super horizon scale? That means why are they frozen outside of our universe? And so the lambda CDM does not explain this. So we need something else. And there are many theories, and in particular one that's popular is called inflation. And inflation, I mean, there's a lot of criticism of inflation. There's a lot of good things about inflation. There's a lot of bad things about inflation. One of the bad things about inflation is it starts, you need to assume dark energy. And since we don't understand anything about dark energy, that's kind of a bad start for a theory. So, but inflation starts by assuming dark energy, which we don't know what it is, but let's start with that. But it's very powerful in many ways because you start with dark energy, and then because dark energy accelerates, the universe becomes really, really big, really, really fast. Okay, so this is what this is supposed to represent. You start with dark energy, and bang, the universe is super big. Okay, it's just like 10 to the minus 40 seconds. It's like, it's really fast. And then if you're expanding like this really fast, it turns out that small quantum fluctuation from quantum mechanics will also get amplified. The wavelength of these small quantum perturbations gets stretched. And then the idea is that when inflation ends, these small perturbations, which were quantum in origin, are now huge. And these are the things that we see today. It's a pretty cool theory, right? I mean, these perturbations are huge. They're outside of our universe. We see them when we expand. Somehow they are quantum in origin. So that's the claim of inflation. Here's the movie that I made myself. It's not as good as the other movies. So we start with dark energy, which I don't know what it is. So it's a blue blob here. And it's some size. This is our universe. It's very small. In fact, if you put the numbers, it's really, really small. So it has some dark energy. Call it lambda. This is the lambda of CDM. And you start with a smooth universe. And then what happens if you have dark energy, just get really big, really fast. In fact, so fast that we see only this part. We you know, the thing is going faster than the speed of light. So we can't see. If there's anything here, we cannot see it. So we only see our universe. The thing we can see is just right here. And then it just keeps on going. Just inflation, it's really big. Just this is dark energy. Just pushes everything away very fast. So, right, inflation is really weird. It does many things. So it's a very violent event. So what happens is that you have this huge inflated universe, and small quantum fluctuation grow, and they get just large. Like they are small quantum fluctuations. So imagine this is a fluctuation of space-time, and it just keeps on going. I've just shown like one wavelength. And they just, as time goes by, these quantum fluctuations just keeps growing, and you keep creating them. And the idea is you create them all with the same, roughly it's always the same thing. Nothing has changed, right? So every time you create a new wave, a new perturbations, it just has the same power in it. It's the same magnitude. So that's why you have the same power in every wave. And you just keep creating them, and they keep stretching because of the expansion of the universe, which is super, super fast. So that's the basic idea. You don't do anything. That's why inflation is popular. You just start it, and then you look at the quantum theory, and the quantum theory tells you you should have those perturbations. You don't have to put them in. So it's a lot more satisfying than just saying, here they are. You know, here you have an explanation for them. And then at some point, inflation stops. Oops. This takes a while. Come on. Inflation stops, and then the universe starts cooling down. So now it goes back to being just a bath of photons, electrons, and a bunch of stuff. And then normal Big Bang goes, okay? And so what happens, and then the normal history goes, and your universe starts growing. So the circle starts growing. And then as you grow, you suddenly see these perturbations. So this theory predicts, tells you that there should be a huge universe outside waiting for us to just expand into, okay? So as we expand, we see these perturbations that were created at before the Big Bang, if you want, during inflation. And then the dark matter just falls in the potential wells, just falls in the curvature. Okay? And then you get the structure. So that's one possible theory to explain where these perturbations come from. Okay? And it works pretty well. It has also some conceptual flaws. It's not as well tested as the lambda CDM, but it's one possible explanation. Any questions? Okay, I think you probably had the. So let me conclude here. So what have we done? The biggest things are really big. That's my first message. Here they are. Really big, okay? Big objects, big galaxy cluster, they're recent. But don't worry. We have a theory. Here it is. It works pretty well. You shouldn't trust it, but it works well. And yep, it's great because it works well. And also, it may be wrong. So that's another reason for it to be great. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Take some.
I think we have some time for questions.
Okay. Yeah, I'm
super. You guys have some questions?
Yeah. Yes.
Why is it that inflation would stop occurring? Why wouldn't it just indefinitely continue to?
Yes, that's in fact that's the original proposal by Alan Guth actually, and when he first invented the theory, that's exactly the problem it had. It was unable to stop it. And so you had to figure out a way to stop it. And so the so-called model of old inflation, which is the first model of inflation proposed, is still known today not to work because it doesn't stop. So we need new inflation, which is invented a little later, which stops. And the idea there is you somehow have to have a mechanism for the dark energy to suddenly want to decay into radiation. So one proposal for dark energy, as already mentioned, is like vacuum energy. But it could be that it's like something, it's like a condensate. What's a good example? Yeah, so you have some vacuum energy, but it's unstable. And as long as it's stable enough for long enough, it's going to inflate. And then as soon as, it just suddenly decays, sort of has a lifetime, if you want. So it inflates for a little while, and then poof, it just decays into radiation. So you have, this is where inflation gets a little less beautiful than what I've told you. It becomes a little bit of a model building. You have to like fine tune a little bit for the dark energy to stay long enough and then decay. And you want it to not decay too fast. And you want it to, yeah. So there's a bit of, you have to crank and change the things. And this is where it's a little less beautiful of a theory. The idea is simple. But indeed, one of the problems you want it to end. And for it to end, you need to be not quite constant dark energy. It needs to be time dependent. And then it becomes a bit more involved. That's the basic idea. Yes? After the inflation? Yeah, so this is where general relativity is just, if you have dark energy and then just decays to radiation, you will naturally just keep expanding. It's just eventually you may stop because of gravity, but you have. If you just, essentially, it's not, you have no choice. If I put that much radiation, into a small volume, and I just tell me what, just ask Einstein theories of gravity, what does the space-time do? It expands. And so it's just what happens. So when you decay suddenly, you decay to a back photon. And in fact, the decay of the dark energy is what I consider to be the Big Bang. So in fact, often people think of the Big Bang as the initial singularity, if there is such a thing. That would be before inflation, which is fine. But before inflation, I don't know what happened. I don't even know if inflation happened. But what happens during inflation is you have this huge universe, and suddenly all the vacuum energy converts into photon. That's essentially a big explosion. That's the explosion right there. You have all the space-time suddenly converting into a fireball of photons and protons and neutrons. And then, poof, you have the normal Big Bang theory that goes on from there. So inflation naturally sets up the initial condition for the normal Big Bang expansion. All right, the other questions? I thought. Yeah, Bjorn.
Yeah, I have a quick question about the gravitational redshift you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that, okay, if we assume that there is lots of dark matter out there, is it possible that the dark matter is causing the redshift that we're seeing? And rather than, for example, the expansion of the universe or something else?
It's an interesting question. It could be. You have to test it. I mean, if we just put what the number are of what we think dark matter is and how much matter there is, it's not enough to create the effect. But you know, maybe if you have maybe there could be a theory actually where you try to explain this. There is even the dark energy. I mean, I should not say the dark energy the dark energy today is a fact that you should take for granted. Again, dark energy, we don't have that much evidence for it. And there are ways to explain. So the idea is we look at supernovas, we look at the redshift, and they look like the universe is accelerating. So they look like they're too far compared to what they should be. But maybe we just missed out. Maybe there is maybe there's some dust in between, so the supernova looks farther. Maybe we're living in a small void where somehow there's nothing around us, and it makes the space-time look weird. I mean, there are different ideas out there.
But are proofs that we have for the expansion of the universe are based all on the redshift, or is there other evidence out there for the expansion?
Let's see. But there's a redshift for like everything has a redshift, including like the cosmic microwave background. So no, I think that the expansion, the Big Bang, it's a whole picture fitting together. Also, like everything. Like this for the movie I made a little bit about the structure. If you don't put in the expansion, you're not going to get the right answer. So I think the direct evidence is the redshift, but there's a lot of indirect evidence for the whole picture to fit together. So that one is a little less contentious, I think, the expansion of the universe by itself. The fact that it's accelerating is more contentious, but the fact that it's expanding is pretty solid, I would say. Yes. That's how we know. And it's not much, but that's what we have for evidence.
Yeah, so is there, because you mentioned in the very beginning that in the puzzle there might be missing mass, so probably there's another formula in
mm-hmm.
a larger scale. Is there any automated theory?
Yeah, there is modified gravity. There's also modified MUND, which is modified Newtonian dynamics. And so these are the ideas. You change gravity to, instead of putting dark matter, you just say, I'm going to have a new theory of gravity.
So what changes the gravity, like extra dimensional?
They don't have, there's no compelling whole, I would say, like, it's more of a phenomenological approach. You just say, how can I fit the data by modifying Newton's law? And you say, oh, I need to modify Newton's this way, and then that fits the data. And it's a fine explanation, because we're trying to test Newton's law. You should not assume that because it's valid on the Earth, it's going to be valid for galaxies. And so the statement that people make is that many galaxies can be explained by a new Newton's law, a different law, which fits the galaxies. The theory has been under stress recently, I think, in my opinion, for two reasons. One is the bullet cluster. It's much harder in these theories to explain the bullet cluster that I've shown you. The other thing is there's a whole consistency picture, in particular with the perturbation, the whole movies and so forth, you know, getting the perturbations right. So, but these alternative theories are being, you know, the research is going on in these fields, and until we know better, the research should be done both on dark matter and on alternative theories of gravity. There's a question here.
Mm-hmm. G was not exactly the value we're using. It's possible to change G. Could change for some reason?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Maybe it's not the gravity that's happening. What's happening is the actual constant. Newton's law is perfect, but G actually changes. It could change as a function of space, or as a function of time. Or as a function of space-time. You know, there are no difference between the two. So yeah, so these constant of nature may not be constant. And so, and indeed, so we look, we have, there's research, there's observation trying to test whether G could vary. Also, there's the fine structure constant. That's a big popular one, and this is the one with electricity. That's the strength of electromagnetism. So the fine structure constant, people are looking for variation as a function of space-time. So on the Earth, they're known to be constant to a very good precision. But in the universe, because we're looking at much larger time interval and much larger distances, it could be that they change. Up to now, there's no evidence for any change in the constant of nature. They seem to be constant. But this is a question which is not, you know, which we have to test. We should not assume that it's true. No, so the question is whether dark matter is also subject to electromagnetism, for example. And actually, no, that's, if it was, we would have seen it. Because everything that's charged under electromagnetism, like the electron and the protons, they all emit light. Light is the carrier of the force for electromagnetism. So if you couple to electricity and magnetism, you will couple to light. And if you couple to light, we should have seen them, because we see light. So the one thing that's new about this particle, it doesn't couple to light. That's the one thing we know for sure. If it's a particle, it has a very, very weak coupling. You know, maybe it couples, but it's so weak that we don't see it. I think there was a question here.
So how can the universe expand at a speed that's faster than the speed of light? How is it possible?
Yes, so the idea is nothing is moving. So really, you should think of space-time, think of it as a grid. You know, of just a coordinate grids, like points. And the point is that there's nothing moving faster than the speed of light. It's just a grid that is expanding. It's a relative velocity. Another example that I like is if I have a laser pointer, and I point it here, and I just move like this. I don't have one, but there's a pointer laser there, and a little dot, and I move it like this. Now, in the laser, there's photons going up and then touching the ceiling. Each photon is moving the speed of light. See? That's, but when I move like this, the dot on the ceiling could be moving very fast, even though I don't move very fast. In particular, if the dot was on the moon and I move just a little bit, it will look like the dot is moving very fast on the moon. It will look like the dot is just like suddenly going from one side of the moon to the other. And that will be faster than the speed of light. But nothing has been moving. The dot is not an object on its own. The photons are all moving in the speed of light. The dot is just where the last photon ended. It's not a photon on its own. It's just, you know, it's so in some sense, it's not the galaxies which is moving faster than the speed of light. It's where the galaxy used to be. It's just a point in space-time. So yeah, I don't know if that helps. it's a little bit mind-blowing. I always have but the idea is the objects themselves are moving slow, you know, relatively slow, but it's just the space-time, which is expanding, and it looks like things are moving faster than the speed of light. All right, yes, question maybe coming to be.
Why would space-time be stretching?
Well, so that's the expansion. So that's the thing, again, so this is a theory of Einstein's theory. It just doesn't want to sit, it doesn't want to be static. Einstein was really upset about this originally. His theory predicted that the universe would be always expanding or contracting. There was no way to find a solution where it would just stay put and the space-time would not move. The only way he could figure this out was to put a cosmological constant in. And so originally, when Einstein's theory, when he added the cosmological constant, the reason is he wanted to put some anti-gravity to cancel the gravity so that everything would be static. That's why he put it in. And then he says, oh, that was my biggest mistake, because a couple of years later, Hubble found that the universe was expanding. So Einstein was very mad because he could have predicted it. If he would have been a little bit more bold, he would have said the universe must be expanding because that's the only solution of the theory. Instead, he tried to fake it. But the point is that Einstein's theory, it just doesn't want to sit. If you put stuff in, it will naturally expand. Which I guess is not really explaining why it does, come to think of it. I'm not really answering the question.
It's advanced because it can.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know what, yeah. All right, more question here, yeah. Yeah, well, and so if for it to interact, to actually touch, it would have to have some size, essentially. And so it could be, we don't know exactly what it is, so it could be the fact that they don't interact seem like, and that picture seemed to point out that maybe the dark matter is a very small object. And so what you have is a very tenuous, very dilute gas, a very small particle. And so, for example, in this room, if I was to suddenly move the air from this room to the other one, they will go to each other, you know, roughly without each particle. Maybe not a good example. The dark matter is really much more dilute than the gas in this room. So anyway, but the point is, the small particles, a gas of it, and they almost don't touch. Yes.
Maybe just one more question. We're almost out of time.
Okay. So last question. Okay. Yeah. So can you repeat, sorry? No. So the question is whether we know any of the other interactions of dark matter to other forces. And the answer is no, we don't. We don't know. The weakly interacting massive particle, the idea is it should interact with the weak force. So the weak force is the force that's responsible for the weak nuclear force. Is the one that's responsible for beta decay, for radioactivity. So the idea is it should interact with the weak force. That's one of the hypotheses. And if it interacts with the weak force, we should see it maybe, for example, at the LHC, or we should see it at SNOLAB. But maybe it doesn't have even a weak interaction, in which case maybe it only has a strong nuclear interaction. Maybe it doesn't have any interaction that we know. Maybe it's a new one. We have no clue. The only thing we know for sure is it has a gravitational interaction. Okay. All right. Okay, good. So. Great. Well, I hope you enjoy your program. It's going to be really fun. Good.